I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show, when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, we're going to take a peek inside the minds of animals. We'll learn about animal friendship, how relationships develop, and what they look like. We spoke with UPenn primatologist Robert Seifert and Dorothy Cheney, as well as veterinarian James Serple. We'll also listen to my conversation with primatologist Franz de Waal about animal intelligence. He joined us earlier this year to discuss his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? But first, we'll hear about the psychology of dolphins with Diana Reese of Hunter College, who has studied self-awareness. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We begin our show about animal minds with dolphins. Scientists have long marveled at the sea mammals' ability to learn, to think, and perform. Hunter College professor of psychology Diana Reese has looked at another facet of the dolphin brain that taps into their high-level thinking, self-awareness. She explored the topic in her 2011 book, The Dolphin in the Mirror. Let's take a listen. I know research with animals in mirrors is important, and dolphins are not the only animals that this research is being used with. But why is it important? Why is mirror research so important?
Well, the mirror is actually a very interesting research tool because it lets us get a reflection of other minds, other animal minds. And, of course, we're part of the animal world. So many years ago, let's say before 1970, we actually thought we were the only species to be able to recognize ourselves in a mirror. And while it seems simple, it's not so simple. It takes some brain power. My colleague Gordon Gallup in 1970 published a groundbreaking study that was published in Science saying that our closest relatives, the great apes, could do it as well. And then that was followed by studies showing all the other apes could do it.
And the idea is that a great ape would look in the mirror and recognize himself or herself, saying that is me?
Right. And there's a certain technique that's used, so we have good controlled conditions and we can actually discern that they understand it's themselves. There's actually what's called the mark test, where you mark the animal and see if they go to the mirror and touch themselves or look at the mark.
In fact, that's the research that you did with dolphins. This is a number of years ago where you were working with some dolphins and you marked the side of their body, and you had mirrors as well.
Right. We actually did that in 2001. It was published in the National Academy of Science, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. It was the first evidence that a non-primate could do it. And again, not all primates do it. Monkeys never seem to show this. So we exposed dolphins to mirrors. And then once we saw evidence or signs that they understood it was themselves, then we did what's called this mark test.
And how did you know that they were seeing themselves? Deconstruct this.
Okay. Well, it's actually pretty simple. There are actually three basic stages of behavior that emerge. So if a dolphin's never seen itself in a mirror, or if a chimp hasn't, we first expose them to the mirror. And what they do is this first stage, they act like they check it out to see if there's someone behind it. They show what we call exploratory behavior. They try to look behind or over the mirror to check out if someone's there. Then part of that stage we call social behavior. They act often as if they're looking at another of their own species. So they show typical social behavior towards the mirror. Then they move to a second stage if they understand it's themselves. Second stage is called contingency testing. That's a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
What it means is that they're showing behavior similar to what you see in the old Groucho Marx or Lucille Ball Harpo skit, where you do this highly repetitive behavior and kind of weird-looking repetitive behavior at a mirror. What they're doing is they're figuring out that what they're doing is related to what they're seeing in front of them. They're trying to figure it out, and they generally do if they show the next phase, which is self-directed. Mm. That phase is where they start looking at themselves. They're using the mirror as a tool to see parts of their body. So with dolphins and chimps and even elephants, because I did that study with my colleagues as well, we see they'll open their mouths and look inside their mouths. These are things they can't see without a mirror. They look at their eyes very closely. They'll look at parts of their body, even their genitals, like kids do. They're interested in themselves. They have a concept of self.
And this goes back to the mark test. So you marked these dolphin bodies. And the idea was that they actually looked in the mirror to find the mark on their body?
Well, it was better than that. What they actually did is that the two dolphins, Tab and Presley, that we did the study with that were at the New York Aquarium, I was director of research there at the time, what they did was once they showed that they understood it, that it was themselves in a mirror, we marked them on many different parts of their body. As soon as they were marked, they raced to the mirror and they oriented their body immediately that so that the mark was right at the mirror. They didn't even search for it. They knew where it was because they could feel being marked with this non-toxic marker. And then they looked right away, which was really important because it suggested they understood that they could use the mirror as a tool to see themselves and that there was something on themselves they wanted to see. There was something in mind.
Well, which tells us something about intelligence. And I guess the idea that you would recognize yourself in a mirror means that you think you have a self. And I don't want to, you know, anthropomorphize here, but...
Yeah, we want to be very careful as scientists not to overstate it. So this idea of a mirror and why this is important is that it suggests that, or we should say it demonstrates, that animals can recognize an external version of themselves. And they understand that that is themselves, so they must have some sense of self. Now, quite honestly, most other animals have some sense of self. I mean, dogs and cats and mice, or they'd be bumping into themselves and other things in their environment. So we have a sense of self relative to others spatially and in the environment. But this is giving us a perspective that other animals have a sense of self that we thought was uniquely human.
Well, and you don't want to get into a competitive match about, you know, who's the smartest
animal on
the planet.
I don't think that's a fruitful discussion.
Because we're talking about apples and oranges here in a way.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. When you think about dolphins having evolved separately from us for 95 million years in this aquatic environment, they have social pressures. They have environmental pressures. Their bodies are different. They face different challenges. So I think it's more useful to say, how did this kind of intelligence emerge? And what does that form of intelligence look like? And that's what I've been so interested in doing.
But we are then, though, and you'll forgive me for this, but we are talking about an intelligent creature, right?
Absolutely. And what I keep finding myself saying is there is somebody in there. It's not a person. Dolphins aren't people. They don't have to be people. They're dolphins. And that's marvelous in its own right. And it's not more or less. It's different. But when you work with them close up and personally like I have, I can tell you there are somebodies in there. They just don't happen to be human somebodies. They're dolphin somebodies with different personalities.
How do you describe your work with dolphins? And is relationship the right word?
It's absolutely the right word. And even scientists, I think, who work with mice and rats will often tell you that they feel a kinship and a relationship with many of these animals. When you're working with dolphins, I find it impossible not to have a relationship. These are social animals with big brains. I mean, these are animals that with a level of intelligence that you work with them and you absolutely develop relationships and different relationships with different individuals.
And how big is their brain? What is unique about their brain?
So their brains are unique in many ways. First of all, they are bigger than our brains. Their brains weigh about 1,700 grams compared to our brains at 1,300 grams, but their bodies are bigger. So we can think about brains relative in size to the body size. So our brains are about 7 times the size they need to be for our body, to run our body. Dolphin brains are about 4.2 times the size. Compare that with a chimp brain, that's also a big brain, that's about 2.1 times the size. So dolphin brains are about twice the size of a chimp brain relative to their bodies, closer to human brains than other animals. But they're complex brains. They have lots of neurons, lots of brain cells packed into that brain. And it's a very complicated, what we call a highly encephalized brain. But it's different as well. Their brains, the areas of their brains are located in different regions so that our visual cortex, where we perceive visual stimuli, is at the back of our brain. For dolphins, it's at the top. Hmm. But the most important thing is that where we do much of our higher processing is in the frontal lobes. And we haven't discerned a particular region that we'd say is analogous to a frontal lobe. So it may be somewhere, it may be more distributed
as you say, this is really a non-terrestrial thinking. Makes sense because of their evolution. But you also say that their ancestry takes them back to goats and cows and other, I guess, what, hoofed creatures?
Yeah, dolphins. Dolphins shared an ancestor with the even-toed ungulates, cows, goats, sheep. And it's interesting when you look at dolphin behavior, you know, they don't look very much like them, but some of the postures they take when they're interacting and some of their behaviors are quite reminiscent of what we see. But their social behavior and their intelligence is much more like what we find in great apes or elephants or humans.
And they have this incredible sonar system.
Yeah, they have this really marvelous natural sonar system, what we call biosonar. And I think the military is quite envious of this.
Because they can use it to navigate in such precise kinds of ways.
Yeah, they've been shown that they can detect differences between something, a difference between a penny and a nickel and even thinner substances and materials. Yeah, it's also been speculated that perhaps dolphins can sort of view the inside of each other, much like we use our devices to see infrasound, to see, you know.
What do you mean by that?
So that the idea is that their sonar can actually penetrate tissue. I mean, we certainly can do that when we're looking at our fetuses. And the question is, do they really do that? We don't know for sure, but theoretically, they should be able to do that. And there have been some, there's just been some interesting anecdotes about that I've heard about people who are pregnant. Dolphins will often scan their bellies. And it could be that they're larger, but it could also be that they're detecting something. So that's a lot of very interesting things that we could learn more about in the future.
You also say they don't have great vision.
No, they actually do have pretty good vision.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah, there was a view many years ago that because they're such incredible acoustic processors, they have a really big area of their brain to process the sound, and they have biosonar, that maybe they didn't have good vision, but actually it's been shown they do. Mm-hmm. And some of the work I did for part of my PhD thesis and the work that others have done have shown they actually see very well. And in fact, their eye is structured in such a way they can actually see through the air-water interface.
So they can
look through the water, the surface. They can look up from through the water and see something in the air, and it's not terribly distorted. So they actually have really good vision.
I'm also curious, and you tell in the very beginning, we almost don't have time to go into the detail, but in the beginning of your book, you talk about a really interesting story involving a whale that we knew that had gotten stuck and essentially couldn't get unstuck. And you use dolphins to help get this whale, I guess, out into the ocean.
Actually, we didn't. I think there was a story where a dolphin actually went in and got another dolphin out in another area. But in the case of Humphrey, that was a humpback whale.
Right.
Humpback whale came into San Francisco Bay waters in 1985. And whales come in, but they don't work themselves up 60 to 80 miles inland. And I was involved in that rescue with many people, but I was put in charge of the playback experiment where we played sounds back to Humphrey. We used oikomi, by the way, that beating of pipes just like the Japanese do, to make an acoustic barrier to drive him downward. But he was all the way up near Sacramento, and we brought him back down. And we played sounds back to Humphrey, and he basically came right to the boat to these sounds of humpback whales feeding. And it was the first successful playback that had been done, and we got him out of the Golden Gate Bridge area.
Wow.
And there's a great story in the book of what happened once he left. He came back, and we had a remarkable experience that I talk about in the book.
That was my 2011 conversation with Diana Reese, Hunter College professor of psychology, dolphin researcher, and author of The Dolphin in the Mirror. She has since elaborated on her work, which she outlined in her TED Talk called The Interspecies Internet, available online. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from primatologist Franz de Waal about new research on animal IQ. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review, Animal Minds Edition. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks again for joining us today. Frans de Waal is a unique kind of primatologist. The Dutch-American researcher and professor of psychology at Emory University has spent most of his work focusing on the social intelligence of primates. This includes things like social organization, sexual relationships, empathy, and cooperation. In his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?, de Waal questions the previous methods of testing animal smarts and believes that animals are much smarter than we give them credit for. Let's take a listen. I hate to start with a definition, but your book has this word smart in it. What do we mean, or what do you mean by smart?
Well, smart relates to intelligence. So cognition is more like how you process information, and that's for each species quite different because, let's say, an echolocating bat has very different information than the one that you have. So the cognition of a bat is different. But intelligence and smartness has more to do with finding solutions in a flexible way to the problems that you face. And if you're good at that, right, then you're considered smart.
As problem solvers,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
I remember years ago interviewing a guy from Harvard University, actually Howard Gardner, and he talked about humans and our various kinds of intelligences. Mm-hmm. There's the sort of athletic intelligence, artistic, linguistic, people skills, things like that. Does that help us understand the kinds of intelligences that animals have?
Yeah, in a way.
Yes and no?
Yeah, so in that's within a species, but I'm, of course, more concerned with between species.
Yes.
Like, how do you compare an octopus and a bat and a chimpanzee and a human? And I think all of them have different kinds of cognitions, dependent on their senses and dependent on where they live and how they live. And it's very hard to compare them. Now, people compare them all the time, especially when it comes to humans, because they always want humans on the top. And to me, that's a sort of silly problem that I don't want to deal with. Is, are you smarter than an octopus? Is, for me, not an interesting question. Because
I'm not an octopus, right?
Yeah, you can read and write, and that's wonderful. And I don't think the octopus can do that. Even though if the octopus would write, it would write 8 books at the same time. Would be great. But for the octopus, that's not relevant. And the octopus has a totally different nervous system. It's spread out over the arms and everything. So why would I want to compare whether you're smarter or not? I could compare the cognition. I could say, what kind of cognition do you have, right, versus the octopus? But this whole contest idea, like which one of the two is better, is a sort of silly question to me.
Is that an old question? I mean, I think, as I recall, even Darwin talked about, you know, the fact that we were sort of on the top of the pile when it came to evolution, mm-hmm, intelligence, adaptation.
Well, I don't think Darwin would say that for evolution. But,
okay,
but he fell for the Scala Naturae, which says that God is at the top, and then right under God comes the human. And so we're very proud of that. And then we go down the scale with fish and then mollusks and whatever. Worms at the bottom or whatever. And that scale has been a popular pastime of many people who have always compared up and down the scale. But the scale doesn't really exist. I consider all these species more like a bush and their specializations. It's a bush with many different specializations. And yes, humans are great at language, for example, which I consider a uniquely human characteristic. But we're not so great at some other stuff. For example, certain memory tasks that some animals are better at.
Well, in fact, talking about a memory task, you write about a chimpanzee, Ayumi. Am I pronouncing?
Ayumo, I believe, yeah.
This chimpanzee who looks like has a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. What can Ayumo do?
So Ayumu can look at a computer screen on which 9 numbers appear and tap them in the right order. That by itself is already quite remarkable. And the numbers always appear in
meaning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7?
Yeah, in the right order, and they always appear in different formats. But the interesting thing is that the numbers disappear within 200 milliseconds. That's like in the blink of an eye. So you barely get to see them. And then he has to tap the squares behind which the numbers are, so he cannot see the numbers anymore. And he can do that. And he has been tested against humans.
And done better?
Done much better. So a British memory champion was sent to Kyoto to compete with Ayumu. and failed. The BBC was going to film it and broadcast it, but the guy was so embarrassed by it that he didn't permit them to put it on the internet. But a humor is better than people, and some psychologists have been very upset by that. I don't know why, because mm-hmm. there's so many things that animals can do that are better than us. You know, you give a dog a smelling task, and of course he's going to beat us. So I don't know why they were so upset, but they went into training to see if they could do it, and they could do it with five numbers, but not with the nine.
So is that adaptation for him to have this flash memory?
Well, we don't know what it is good for. We don't know.
So why can he do this?
Yeah, we don't know why he has that capacity. But for me, the interesting part was that people got upset by it because they always frame these things in terms of competition. Are we the smartest of them all? And we really aren't. And it's not even an interesting question, I think. The question we have certain specializations, especially when it comes to symbols and abstraction. We are very good at that. And why not leave it at that and say that we're good at that, but other animals are good at other things, you know?
I mentioned the word neo-creationism in my introduction, something that you mm-hmm. write about in this book. What do you mean by that? And how does that help us understand what we're talking about?
Okay. Well, creationism is that you don't believe in evolution. You think the world was created 6,000 years ago or something like that. But neo-creationism, so creationism you don't find much among academics, the general academics. But neo-creationism is very prevalent in philosophy, anthropology, psychology, and so on, outside of biology, basically, which basically assumes that, yes, we evolved, and all animals evolved, but evolution stops at the human head. The human head and brain and mind are different things and are not really comparable with, let's say, an animal mind. And that's a very common position. So people don't even want to make these comparisons. And as soon as you make a comparison with, let's say, chimpanzee intelligence, they say you're anthropomorphizing, mm-hmm. you're not scientific, because, of course, a chimpanzee cannot reconcile or have empathy or whatever. So they try to create distance, whereas, of course, as a biologist, I'm trained as a biologist, we in biology and medicine and neuroscience, we think there's continuity everywhere.
Yeah. Well, this idea that evolution stops at the human head, I mean, evolution never stops, right?
I mean,
this is this constant evolving process. This is the world that we all live in.
But also everything we have has evolved. So the human brain, there's nothing in the human brain that is really new. The human brain is big. So it's three times bigger than a chimpanzee brain, and we can be very proud of that. But it's not a different brain. There are no parts in there. There's no neurotransmitters in there that other animals don't have. If you go back to the insects even, you will find neurotransmitters that are the same that we wow. have. So there's an enormous continuity in brain. And that's why, for example, people will do studies on fear in rats to find solutions to human phobias, for example. So in neuroscience, we are very used to the continuity, and we assume that a rat brain operates in basically the same way as a human brain. So this whole story that the human brain and the mind are special, we don't necessarily believe in.
You have actually a picture in your book of the kind of testing that's done where we might compare a child doing a task and an animal, or in this case, I'm looking at it, an ape doing a mm-hmm. task. And mm-hmm. you're basically saying it's really not fair because mm-hmm. on the one hand, there's a screen between the tester and the ape, whereas in this other picture, there's a child and reaching out for a toy, no yeah. screen that's separating the tester and the testee.
Yeah, so children are usually tested sitting on the lap of their mom or their dad, which is already a huge problem. We don't do that with the apes, but it's a huge problem because parents are never neutral about their children. They want their children to be the genius of the block, you know. So they nudge them and they may give solutions or they're sitting there. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, of course, that children are tested by their own species. The chimpanzee is tested by us, which is a different species. That puts chimps immediately at a disadvantage. And so to compare, people have done a lot of these comparisons, and usually children come out as smarter and having concepts that the apes don't have. But to give an example, we have done a lot of studies on imitation. So it used to be concluded from these kind of experiments that apes don't imitate. Apes don't ape, people would literally say. So and that was tested by using a puzzle box, and a human would open the puzzle box, and the child, if you work with a child, the child will copy what you do. The chimp will not copy what you do. And they had concluded from this that means that the apes don't have an imitation capacity. But when we started testing apes with apes, so now they were dealing not with humans, they were dealing with their own species, all of a sudden they were excellent at it. They're very good imitators, but they need to have a model that they can relate to. And so that's always the issue, and that's why in the book I say negative evidence has very little meaning. We have seen a lot of negative evidence where people say, we have not found this or we have not found that. And the question for me is then immediately, did you test the animal in the right way? That's the question, really.
There's this famous marshmallow test, and, uh-huh. and that was a test also given to chimpanzees.
But also to a parrot.
And to a parrot.
And the parrot was actually also very good at controlling its urges to eat the marshmallow, you know, or in this case, different food. But the marshmallow test is you ask the animal to wait to get a better food. And chimps can do that. So that's emotional control. It's basically free will, even, some people have said. So
well, and the idea of delaying some degree of gratification.
Yeah. And you have to control your emotions to do that. Yeah.
You talk about, in the book, you talk about gratuitous
anthropomorphism.
Yes. Yeah, and gratuitous anthropomorphism.
Well, the bad anthropomorphism is if you overinterpret what an animal does, or project your human feelings on them. So, for example, people go swimming with the dolphins, which I don't think is a good thing for the dolphins, but they do that at certain hotels. And they say, well, of course, the dolphins, they love it because look at all these smiley faces. Now, the dolphin has no options. The dolphin has that face, and it may look smiley to us, but that doesn't mean they're happy about the whole thing. But people project their feelings on animals very easily. And we, as scientists, we need to sort of stay away from that and be a little bit skeptical about certain things. But on the other hand, this enormous fear of anthropomorphism that we've seen in the last century, where everything you proposed about animals was immediately shut down by saying, well, you're being anthropomorphic. That is exaggerated, especially with animals as close to us as the apes. The apes are almost anthropomorphic by definition because the anthropoids, they're human-like. That's what that means. And so if you tickle an ape and he makes sounds like and he has a laughing expression on his face, that is laughing. They are laughing because they are like us and they have the same sort of responses. They kiss each other when they greet each other. They laugh when you tickle them and so on. And we need to use the same terminology for what they do.
In fact, you use that I'm having a hard time talking to a primatologist.
Anthropomorphism, yeah.
Yeah, the denial part of that, which is sort of denying what's in front of our face, right?
Yeah, I think the bigger problem in the previous century has been not anthropomorphism, but anthropodenial.
Right.
The bigger problem is people who wanted to keep animals at a distance and wanted to drive a wedge between them and us by stating that all animals are sort of instinct machines or stimulus response machines, and we are the only ones who can think. And as a result, they have created this distance, an artificial distance, and I call that anthropodenial, is that you deny the connection between you and your close relatives. And that applies certainly to the apes, but I would say it applies basically to all mammals, is that we should not be so scared of anthropomorphism.
I mean, some of the videos that I've seen of elephants, for instance, and again, I don't know if I'm anthropomorphizing what I am seeing, but it looks like you see families and the kind of emotions that one would recognize in a family, the kind of caring devotion that we see, helping a baby elephant out of a hole or out of a ditch somewhere.
Yeah. So those are, let's say, the positive behaviors like empathy and helping and caring and attachment, which we see in many species, especially in mammals and birds. We see quite a bit of that. But the real issue is, do the animals suffer and how and when do they suffer? And can we reduce that? Is there a way for us to eliminate that or at least reduce it? And especially in the agricultural industry, which are really the big numbers, that's where the big numbers of animals, the circuses are small numbers compared with that. In that agricultural industry, the treatment of animals is horrific in my mind. And I think we need to start changing that. Of course, there is already an enormous push to do that. I think the push is sometimes a bit extreme in the sense that people say you need to go vegan. Well, that means that that 90% of the people is not going to follow you because they're not going to do that. And if you want to have 100% of the people behind you, which really should be your goal, you should go for a goal like improving conditions. Yeah.
Speaking of elephants, and you and some others have done some fascinating research using mirrors.
Yeah.
And a mirror, of course, raises all sorts of questions about who, when an elephant looks in a mirror, are they seeing themselves?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Walk us through that.
Yeah. So there are many animals who respond to their mirrors by total confusion. So there are certain small birds who keep attacking their mirror image, for example, and they never give up. There's other animals who learn to ignore. So your cats and dogs at home, they learn to ignore the mirror, basically. And there are a few animals, only a handful, who make the connection between their mirror image and themselves. Mm. And that's often called self-awareness, even though I think it's a bit black and white in the sense that I don't think a cat who doesn't recognize itself is not self-aware to some degree. But elephants and dolphins and the great apes and humans and the magpie.
And the magpie,
and the,
right.
Those are the self-recognizing animals that we have at this moment, who you can test. You can put a mark on them. Let's say you put a mark on an elephant above its eye, something that he cannot see without a mirror, and you put him in front of a mirror, and he will start inspecting with his trunk that mark because he connects his own face with his own body, basically.
Well, you mentioned something about cats and perhaps even dogs, that even if they don't look at themselves in the mirror, they are self-aware?
Well, they're not totally confused, as some fish and some birds are who look at that mirror image as somebody else.
Right.
So at least our pets, and that's why we can have mirrors in the home. Imagine that you had mirrors in the home and your dog would every day would keep attacking that mirror image. We wouldn't be happy with that. And so the fact that they learn to ignore that is a big step up already.
Well, it's interesting to think about a mirror and an animal recognizing themselves in a mirror and whether that says that they know who they are.
Oh, that's a big step.
It is a big step. I mean, can we make that step?
No, I feel that thing is absolute. So some scientists are like that. They say that the ones who recognize themselves in the mirror are self-aware,
right,
and all the rest is not self-aware. And I think that's much too absolute to say it that way. Because let's take when two dogs wrestle and in play, they will bite not their own legs or their own tails. They will bite those of the other. So they make a distinction between their own body and somebody else's body, which is already a form of self-awareness in my mind.
Right.
So I think all animals have some degree of self-awareness. They have to have that in order to act in the world, so to speak. But the mirror test taps into something that is bigger than that. And we don't know exactly what that is, but it's only the large-brained, the largest-brained animals who can do that kind of thing.
That was my interview with primatologist Franz de Waal, recorded earlier this year. His newest book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? When we continue our look into the minds of animals after the break, we'll hear about animal friendship. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We conclude our show about the minds of animals by listening back to my conversation about animal friendship. Now, friendships between people are hard enough to define, so imagine examining the nuances of companionship among non-human animals. But scientists have found that just like humans, animals foster relationships for love, for belonging, support, and even health benefits. We learned about research on animal buddies when we were joined by University of Pennsylvania primatologists Robert Seifert and Dorothy Cheney, as well as veterinarian James Serpel. He directs the University of Pennsylvania Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society. Let's take a listen. If we're talking about animal friendship, what does a friendship between two baboons look like?
Well, the primary way in which baboons manifest a friendship is through grooming. So two individuals will groom each other back and forth. It tends to be reciprocal. And some studies have shown that sort of physiologically being groomed feels great, sort of like having a back rub.
Would you say that's a friendship? I don't want to get too you know, mired in language here, but are we talking about friendships?
Well, if you look at baboons, as Dorothy says, and you observe their behavior, friendship is certainly a good way to describe it. It persists, we now know, for 15, 20 years often, and it has the characteristics that we associate with friendships. These animals interact with each other often in many different ways, and it certainly looks like friendly interactions of one sort, like forming alliance, affect, grooming. But the other interesting thing is that it's not an anthropomorphic term because we've done experiments that ask the baboons, do you recognize the friendships that other animals have? And it looks like they do. And you can design an experiment in which, for example, you wait until two adult female baboons are sitting together and they're just resting. And you can, from your library of sounds that you've recorded from all the members in the group, you can put together a sequence of sounds, threatening vocalizations, screams and things, that make it sound like two individuals are having an aggressive interaction off behind the bushes, and see how these two subjects respond. And if you play a sequence of vocalizations that makes it sound like just any two individuals are interacting, the subjects don't look very much. But if you play a sequence that makes it sound like the close associate of one of them is involved in a fight, the other one will look at that one. And sort of like looking at the mother when the offspring is involved in a fight. And if you play a sequence that makes it sound like their two close associates are involved in a fight, they look at each other. Hmm. So they seem to associate a particular vocalization with a particular individual, and that individual with its friends.
And can we use the word care, Dorothy? That they care about each other? Because I was thinking, I mean, I was thinking about friendship as I was putting the show together, and what is it that makes us friends with people?
Animals are aware or have some knowledge of other individual social relationships. And you can also take physiological measurements like stress hormones, which you can gather from the scientific terminology is poop collection. So we take fecal samples from baboons, and you can show quite clearly that when a female baboon loses a close relative, say, to a predation by a lion or leopard, her stress levels increase tremendously. And it's only the loss of an individual that that causes these increases in stress levels. Other members of the group who have perhaps witnessed the predation event show no such increase. And in the months subsequent to losing your best friend to a lion or leopard, you can actually see changes in this female's behavior. She appears to make active steps to identify a new friend, to mend her social network.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, James Serple. Do you see animal friendships? Is that something that you have observed in your work?
They certainly are commonly reported by pet owners who have, say, a dog and a cat or two dogs in the household. Sometimes two cats also will form apparently quite intense relationships with each other, which are very exclusive. In other words, they don't show that level of affection and companionship towards necessarily other animals in the household. So it's a sort of special relationship at some level, and this is reported endlessly by pet owners, certainly, yes.
I mean, is that proximity? I feel a little tongue-tied, only because I don't want to use human words to describe animal interactions.
Yes, it's an ongoing pattern of seeking out proximity with the other individual, often mutual grooming, like was described in the baboons, a tendency to play together, to sleep together, to just want to be, in the presence of that one individual. And often people will describe how those animals will then show symptoms of grief or loss when, for example, their friend dies or their friend goes somewhere else or is even just gone for the day. The other animal will show some sort of symptoms, apparently, of separation distress.
We think of, or we often say, dogs are humans' best friends. But I sometimes wonder with my dog if he's just using me.
Well, with this whole conversation, really, it depends on your definition of friendship. But there are some things that people describe getting from their animals, which are definitely we associate with human friendships, like fidelity,
yes,
faithfulness, loyalty to the relationship. That's something that people endlessly describe in terms of their relationship with their dog, because their dog shows towards them, demonstrates towards them
behavior.
You come
home and they're happy to see you.
Exactly. I'm ecstatic to see you, beside themselves. And they do it consistently over time. And this is sending you a very strong message that you are a special individual for this animal.
Right. So are they using us?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily using us. I mean, we're using them, actually, right. I think, in many respects, because of this whole issue of stress reduction and things like that, which are now being described among pet owners when they're interacting with their pets. Yeah. So you've got the same kind of thing going on.
Well, Dorothy and Robert, let me go back to you as well. And even putting the relationships, even the friendships that you have observed, is it about also survival? Is there something that helps these baboons, in this case, survive because they have a close bond with another baboon?
Well, what's becoming really, really interesting is that the more people engage in this long-term research, not just on baboons, but many different animals, including chimpanzees, horses, dolphins, even rats, it's becoming clear that animals who are able, who are highly motivated, perhaps to use you as a friend, highly motivated to form a friendship and perhaps skilled at making and retaining a close bond, tend to have much higher reproductive success. Their offspring survive at higher rates. They live longer. And some of our research on baboons have suggested that even if you just take the mother-daughter bond, which is the strongest, mm-hmm. and you divide mother-daughter bonds into three categories, the strongest ones, the intermediate ones, and the ones that are less good, and we all know that some mothers and daughters get along better than others, you can show quite clearly that females with the strongest bonds with their mothers or daughters have greater longevity, their offspring survive at higher rates. And so it's clearly beginning to be shown in a variety of species, as I say, including rats and dolphins. And so, you know, you ask whether or not your dog is using you, it'd be highly adaptive. I mean, having a close bond or having a close friendship is good for your health.
And you want to add to that? I mean, I'm thinking of evolution, how these bonds have served evolution.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because, of course, we can talk about the way evolution fosters bonds between males and females for mating. But these are ways in which evolution seems to have been fostering bonds between females in a matrilineal society like baboons. And the same holds for a lot of species where males form coalitions, and those coalitions lead to greater mating success.
And James Serpel, let me go back to you and thinking more about the companion animals, the animals that we live with. And it's such a different relationship that humans tend to have with the felines in their lives.
They do, although a lot of people very pro-feline and very pro the relationship with cats. And when you talk to those people, very often I get the impression that the cat really does fulfill the role of an infant for those kinds of folks, perhaps more so than a dog.
Well, the size, right?
The size weight. Is a factor. Cats love to sleep on you, which is a great kind of infant-like behavior. And they can be very affectionate, you know, very adoring. But not all cats, you know, some cats are much less so. And you have to accommodate these individual differences, which are quite significant, especially in cats.
Well, even a meow can sound like a baby's cry sometimes.
Absolutely, yes.
And the big eyes as well.
And
right?
Some of our cat breeds we've selected to meow like a baby crying. And I think that's part of the process that's going on there through artificial selection. We're selecting for animals that do this thing for us. In other words, trigger these responses in us.
And these responses, and this is research that's been done looking at literally how the body responds to an animal.
Indeed, yes. I mean, it turns out that when people are interacting with their animals, all sorts of strange things go on physiologically inside them. There was a neat study came out recently from Japan where they actually found that people whose dogs looked at them a lot had higher levels of a neuropeptide hormone called oxytocin in their urine. And oxytocin, is known as the trust hormone, the bonding hormone. It's a hormone that's closely associated with this process of forming strong attachments for other individuals. So the dog, if you like, is turning the owner on by causing this secretion of oxytocin just by looking at them.
Well, interesting. I mean, it's so tactile what we're talking about, Robert, whether it's between animals or across species or with humans and animals, that relationship is such a physical relationship. I'm thinking of grooming, but also, of course, hugging cats and petting dogs.
And so once you've established that animals who form close bonds live longer and their infants survive better, then that right away means that natural selection is not only going to favor the close bonds themselves, but they're going to favor anything, any kind of behavior or hormonal interaction that promotes close bonds. And if touching, hugging, grooming, sharing food promotes a close bond, natural selection is going to favor that. And that's very interesting because we'd like to know how evolution has shaped this kind of cooperative behavior.
Because I'm thinking it raises questions about loyalty, about, you know, long-term relationships. I mean, what that means for instance, a group of baboons.
And it would be, lovely to try to study, you know, different long-term pairs in baboons or chimpanzees or dolphins or any of these long-lived animals and see, you know, what happens when they break up, you know, what happens when somebody doesn't come to another person's aid.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, we unfriend people on the internet, on Facebook. Do we see this among baboons or other animals, unfriending?
Not to the same degree one would see in humans because, of course, animals are probably not capable of the level of spite and vindictiveness and introspection, certainly, that middle school girls are capable of. but what you do see is that for reasons that we don't yet understand, that some individuals just seem better at maintaining a bond than others. And one of the issues that a lot of scientists are becoming increasingly interested in, it's a very new area, is personality. If we were all sitting around with all the people who've worked at our baboon site at night, say, over a glass of wine, and we were talking about baboons, we'd all agree at some level about who's the nice one and who's the, you know, cranky one. And it sometimes seems as though baboons are also aware of these personality traits, and yet we don't yet quite have a handle on that. One thing we do know is that it's not related to dominance rank.
Interesting.
So that female baboons form very conservative dominance hierarchies where a female inherits her mother's rank. So it's very much like British royalty. But these social bonds and the consequences of the bonds in terms of longevity are not correlated necessarily with high rank.
Interesting. James Serple, I'm thinking about personality, but also how that might tie into breed, you know, a dog breed that seems to favor a certain kind of personality.
Yes, indeed. It's a major component, I think, of our relationships with companion animals is this, we talk about compatibility in marriage, but it's also compatibility in friendships. And, you know, some owner-pet pairs are certainly more compatible than others. And I'm afraid, you know, our animal shelters are full of animals where that relationship is broken down for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And very often, when you ask these people why they're getting rid of the animal, what often comes out is some kind of behavioral incompatibility between the two that the person couldn't deal with.
This goes back in time, but did humans bring, I guess, wolves / dogs into their lives because they needed a friend?
Well, that's a really interesting question and hotly debated because there's, you know, various different schools of thought. Some people thought they were came on board as kind of camp scavengers. Mm. My personal belief is that people adopted these animals as cubs and then reared them as members of the family. And so, yes, I think that bonding aspect was critical to the initial establishment of that relationship. And we have lots of evidence that hunting and gathering people like keeping young wild animals as pets. Hmm. So they capture them when they're out hunting and then they bring them home and they rear them and care for them.
Which is very provocative. I mean, yeah. Wanting something young and fuzzy in their lives.
Well, they spend...
and tactile.
I mean, they spend hours and hours caring for these animals. Hmm. There have been some studies that have actually clocked the number of hours people spend, you know, foraging for food just for the pet. And they will spend 2 or 3 hours a day just getting the food to feed their pets, which is quite significant.
I'm thinking of a line from The Little Prince, something like, it's the time you waste with someone that makes them important.
Mm-hmm. You know,
just to underscore.
And it's bonds with specific individuals, too, because when we were looking at the data on baboons, you know, there you are, a baboon, and there are 23 other females in your group. And you could distribute your grooming equally among all of them. And that would seem like a great thing to do. But baboons don't do that. They really differ. And it turns out that the baboons that had the lowest levels of stress hormones and that seemed to be the most successful by other measures were those who had the most restricted grooming networks. Hmm. They groomed a lot with a few individuals. It's as if the baboons were telling us by their behavior it's better to have a few really close friends than a lot of acquaintances.
The idea of I'm thinking about how puppies can do rough and tumble play. I mean, is that a sign of friendship when we see the kind of roughhousing that animals can do with each other?
Well, it might be the early stages of friendship formation. It might be through those types of interactions that individuals discover who their friends are, if you know what I mean.
That was my 2012 conversation with primatologist Robert Seifert and Dorothy Cheney, as well as animal interaction expert James Serpel. And that wraps up our look at the minds of animals here on Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show with the help of our intern, Madison Poulter. I'm Artie Moscowain. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.